All right, make sure you're in fellowship as here we are beginning, if you will, the third trip to Egypt by Jacob's family. This time it's all inclusive, including Jacob and the rest of the family. And in the trip to Egypt, as we've seen, is not direct without stops. He first makes a stop at Beersheba, where he will engage in worship and offering sacrifices, which was verse 1. So Israel set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father. And it marks a change in the geographical will in regards to the Hebrew race under Jacob's family, which is a turning point in the prophecy that was given to Abraham, that they would be aliens in a foreign land, essentially, and oppressed and enslaved in a period of 400 years. And the first 190 years of that, as we were dealing with that, reconciling a different reference of numbers, as we saw in the writer of Acts by Luke, etc., what all this means. But looking at the 400 years itself, the first 190 years that they are seen as sojourners and aliens in regards to the land of Canaan. And they obviously understood that that is part of the prophecy. Now that's getting ready to change. And for the next 210 years, they will reside in Egypt as foreigners. That did not begin even in enslavement or oppression. They were welcome visitors by Pharaoh himself, and obviously lived a good life initially in regards to living in Egypt. That all changes as time goes on, and they find themselves enslaved, and hence the struggle to leave Egypt at God's perfect timing, as we have recorded for us in Exodus and elsewhere in that respect. But for the last 32, 33 years now, Jacob has been living in Hebron, in Canaan, as God instructed him to do so. Kind of orient us here with the map, if you can read some of it. Hebron here is in this section of the map. Jerusalem being up here. Now he goes from there south to Beersheba. It runs along the, if you will, western border of Canaan. Their ultimate trek is to end up over in Goshen in Egypt, in the Nile Delta region, which this map shows a general proximity of where that would be located at in that vein. Kadesh Barnea here is the most southern region of the Canaanites at that point in time. This map is the long-used conventional map of the Exodus leaving Egypt. And here, as we see, they have them coming down to the western side of the Sinai Peninsula there, coming over and around and then going up and crossing over some stream or whatever river elsewhere to get into the land. As we know, it has them cut across here. They came down through the southern end, came up through the coastline. Then it becomes very cliff-like. They're kind of put at a dead end, probably more along this area right here, if you can see where I'm looking at. And here in the Gulf of Aqaba, they actually came up to here. This is where the Red Sea crossing occurred. And they came right over to Mount Sinai, which is right across the deal, for their first stop after they crossed the Red Sea. It is there that Kankaris, the Pharaoh, knew not Joseph, he and the entire Egyptian army was wiped out. And there was a big turn of history and events for Egypt, the world power, all of a sudden finding itself in demise in that respect. But anyway, gives you kind of a maybe a little orientation of where we're heading. Hebron, down south along the basically the mountainous region into their higher elevation, and then they'll head out. And as they get into Egypt, they ask, they send ahead and ask for Joseph to lead the way to Goshen, have him lead the way to Goshen to where they're supposed to go. So we're dealing here, back to our notes, breaking camp, having lived in Hebron for the past three decades plus a little bit, dating us around 1688 to 1656 B.C., that they went there after Jacob returned from his uncle Laban, and he was there for some 20 years, going on 21. So all this chronology that we've tried to keep up with as we've gone on, that's point 13. This after having returned from Jacob's 20-year stint with his uncle Laban in Haran, which was further up north in regards to geographical region. And as we know, originally he was going to only be there for about 7 years, as he said, I'll sign you a 7-year contract to have your beautiful daughter Rachel as my wife. And his uncle had saw gold in his eyes and saw a gullible man, and he took advantage of him. As we know, the story goes, on the wedding night he swapped out Rachel for her sister Leah in the wedding bed. And he woke up with a different woman in his bed the next day. And that's when Laban came in. And he said, look, don't get all hacked off at me. Whatever excuses he gives. I'll give you Rachel. Just if you'll sign another 7-year contract, and you can have her today. And then over the next 7 years, they crank out 12 kids. 11 brothers and a daughter, Dinah. Joseph and his brothers and daughter Dinah. Benjamin did not was not born until after they headed back home after the fact, and that was not for another 6 years after that that Laban convinced him to hang around and try to make him more money. And as we saw, God reversed all that and pretty much put Laban in a situation of almost becoming destitute and blessing Joseph otherwise, while Laban came in and jacked with him in unethical ways in business and things of this nature. Understand, God protects you. He knows what's going on. He knows who's doing what and all these other things. And He can bless you in spite of what people may be trying to do to you otherwise. But anyway, that's some 21 years almost, 20, going into 21. And then on the trip back, that's when Rachel had the Joseph's young brother, Benjamin, and she died of childbirth. She died sinning to death. And after that return back, that's when he was instructed to go back where his father Isaac was at and stay in Hebron. And that was God's geographical will for him. God has will. His will is known as His sovereignty. In His sovereignty, He expresses directive will. That's what He wants us to think, say, and do. We learn that from the Bible. For those who do not want to line up with what He wants us to think, say, and do elsewhere, He permits that to happen. Hence, He has permissive will that recognizes the existence of free will and volition among the human race concerning God. And then another important aspect is God's geographical will. That aspect of His will is largely void in the thinking of Christians today. You can see that in the evangelistic and fundamentalist denominational world as people will try to claim their whole world as their canon, as their place of authority, and things of this nature. Now, God has geographical will where He wants us to be. And obviously, for the local church, people living in certain geographical regions. First, they must identify with their right pastor teacher, and where he wants them to be is where that he's teaching sound Bible doctrine, and to join themselves in that microcosm assembly of the church universal in that regards. So God has geographical will. And here, now the geographical will is changing. And it's interesting, Jacob picks up enough in regards to gapping that the dream's being fulfilled, recognizing he needs to go and bow down ultimately here to Joseph. But he doesn't take it to its logical conclusion. And this is where this whole trip kind of fits in regards to the scenario following Jacob's thinking. And if you will, still a little shortcoming going on in life, another repercussion, if you will, for his rejection originally of the doctrine of the dream to begin with. So after 21 years, being with his uncle Laban, he returns back where he's supposed to go. That was 28:10 and 29:4. Genesis. He went to Haran to see his uncle Laban. He's on the way, and we'll touch in on this. On the way, he's stops where he's at now at Beersheba. And that's where God appeared to him and communicated with him audibly in regards to as he is running away from his whole situation with Esau and tricking his father Isaac in regards to getting the birthrights and all these other things, all this stuff. This is real life. It's none of this fantasy stuff that the fundies like to try to paint Christianity. Like it's some rose-colored glasses you look through life when you become a Christian, if you're a good Christian and all these other things. No, the Bible paints reality for us. It records it for us in this regard. And he departed from Beersheba and went to Haran. That was verse 10. And then in 29:4, in regards to the men that he met at the well there where he ran into Rachel, he says, "My brothers, where are you from?" They said, "We are from Haran." So we know he went from Hebron up to Haran then back. So 14, now on the way, Israel stops along the southern border of Canaan, southwestern if you want to call it that, and quote, came to Beersheba and offered sacrifice to the God of his father Isaac. Wow, Bo, Beersheba, wow, Zebak, Zebek, Zebak, Lamed, Elohim of Isaac. So 15, now to address the name uses here for Israel and Jacob. Being one of the same, one divine, inspired, emphasizing his maturity. The other, not so much in that regards. So 15, is Israel stopped for worship here in Beersheba? That highlights his ongoing maturity. One of the first pieces of evidence that you'll see in regards to the adjusted mature believer is their consistency and fidelity to their MPR in life, worship of God. Let's see. To stop and offer sacrifice. The sacrifice didn't do anything to save them, as a lot of people want to teach that. A lot of fundies want to teach that. People were saved in the Old Testament by keeping the law. And Jesus had to fight the same mentality at the first advent with the Pharisees. How ironic is that? And here some 2,000 years later, the fundies whooping it up under the Christian banner try to proclaim the same thing. No, they were saved by the same doctrine that we're saved by through faith in their coming Messiah. They look forward in the future in regards to their object of faith. We look back. If you live during the time of Jesus, you look right there. See? So the sacrifices are designed to teach doctrine. They're all symbolic. And they pictured, obviously, the efficacious work of Jesus Christ on the cross, as well as other aspects in regards to doctrinal realities that we align to, such as thanksgiving, peace, principles of peace, reconciliation, and things of this nature. Forgiveness. These all taught doctrine. The tabernacle, the temple, were all symbolic in regards to the very materials that were used and how it was constructed. As we know, it reflects upon the basic concept in regards to the plan of God through Jesus Christ, the temple and the tabernacle do. So, he obviously stopped to contemplate the truth of God's Word, utilizing the method of communication and teaching that they used at that point in time, and that is through ritual, largely through ritual. Also, obviously, through verbal rote, passing on through out time, etc. Doctrine is also passed down. As we know, doctrine is also taught through the stars early on in our history. And while we don't look to astrology or astronomy today to teach us doctrine, it doesn't mean that it doesn't still have doctrinal significance, because it does, as the book of Revelation makes clear. But anyway, we have the written canon of Scripture, Old Testament and New Testament now, in written form for us to follow. So his stop for worship highlights his ongoing maturity, hence Moses' use of the name Israel with respect to coming to Beersheba and offering sacrifices. So 16, now the last word he had from God on the subject of geographical will was to get in Canaan and stay there. That was 31:13, as he appeared. God appeared to Jacob and Haran, where he's still working for his uncle Laban, and told him to pack up and get the hell out of Dodge. And the God of Bethel, where he anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me, now rise, leave this land, return to the land of your birth, as none other than in Hebron, in Canaan. Now he, that being Jacob, to kind of peel back the layers for us here so we can see what's going on, he recognizes that the invitation from Joseph was a major relocation in the plan of God, and now deals with it as such. So like I said, he basically has gapped a dream now. He's got that far. And he recognizes that he's got to go to Egypt, probably, to bow down to his son Joseph, based on the dream. But to stay there on Joseph's invitation, to permanently relocate, now that's what's sticking in his craw here a little bit. That's what he's concerned about. Oh, wait a second now. I'm doing this. God told me to come here. So he's doing the right thing, but he doesn't have the confidence that he's doing the right thing yet, because he has not put two and two together in application of what that dream ultimately means to him. And that is, if he's going to go where Joseph is and bow down and pay homage and be under his authority, then that's going to demand a change of environment. So we bring all that out. So he recognizes that there is a change in God's geographical will. And this is a purpose of why he stops here specifically in Beersheba, to take time to contemplate and study it out, as we would say. Deal with it through prayer and supplication of doctrine and communication of it, looking for divine guidance. So 18, now his offer of sacrifices here would obviously entail various reasons. And we can give many reasons why he might engage in a formal act of worship here, including sacrifice denoting thanksgiving, such as thanksgiving for one, obviously the Abrahamic covenant, the covenant that he has become a part of. He's in line to keep it going through his family, through his lineage, and all the promises associated ultimately for the real estate. Now, none of the early patriarchs got to realize that promise, but they will. It's just later on, as it will be in resurrection body. Two, another thing, obviously, he would get thanksgiving for deliverance from the famine. In our prayer protocols, in our prayer agenda and discipline, we are to pray constantly in thanksgiving. It's so easy in Satan's world, especially, and with the stimulation of the SCA on top of that, to find ourselves getting drugged in thinking about all the bad things going on. Well, how you can find a balance to that is in your prayer life, to continually offer up and consider things to be thankful for. Obviously, that demands that you have to put your thinking cap on. Prayer isn't to be some just memorized rote of words that you go in like a lay me down to sleep type of deal. No, it demands that you take the doctrine in your soul, get in fellowship, and utilize it in your conversing and dialect with God on a personal and a very personal level between you and Him. And we are to do this. We're to pray always. That doesn't mean that you don't have time to think about other things and what you have to do, etc. But it means that prayer is not something that you ever shut the door on. It's not something that you're going to lay aside. It's always to be there in reach. Every time you rebound, you're praying. So obviously, it denotes this consistency, an open door policy by God, and He keeps it open, and hence we are to avail ourselves of that benefit and grace. And then, obviously, the living grace that has been provided in spite of this famine that's going on. And God has provided three news about Joseph. I mean, yeah. For the last 22 years, I thought my son, my favorite son's dead. Now he's alive. You just can imagine the emotions of Jacob at this point in time in his life. He's going to come to grips, obviously, in regards to how he's kind of failed this Joseph test. That's something he's got to live with. But on the other end of the coin, what more happiness and exhilaration to go see your loved one that you have so long thought as lost. And then four, obviously, the importance of this move. The importance of this move to pray concerning as it may relate to the prophecy. And then B, in general, as just general repertoire of a basic doctrine, elementary doctrine that we all obviously would address in our prayers on a personal level. In general, both burnt and peace offerings, such as described in Leviticus 3, to demonstrate His preoccupation with Messiah, the one true sacrifice. The sacrifice in and of itself revolves around the salvation adjustments, rebound adjustments, etc. Leviticus 3. highlights that. Here, under the law of peace offerings. Now, if his offering, the Jew, the Hebrew, the priest, is a sacrifice of peace offerings, he is going to offer out of the herd, whether male or female, he shall offer it without defect before the Lord. The substitute animal is symbolic of the fulfillment through the person of Jesus Christ. The animal that was sacrificed, sheep, bull, ram, whatever, goat, doves, these animals could not have any physical defects whatsoever. They had to be in perfect health and condition. They couldn't have broken legs, broken bones, scarred up all over the place. That was to symbolize the fact that Jesus Christ was pure and innocent in regards to his own life. He was without sin, without imperfection, spiritually. And he shall lay his hand on the head, that's the priest, of his offering, and slay it in the doorway of the tent of meeting, that's the tabernacle. The laying of hand on the head is denotes the authority of transference of the sins of the individual to the person of the sacrifice that the sacrifice symbolizes. And so it denotes that our sins, teaches that our sins that we commit in life have been transferred to the person and body of Jesus Christ and then was judged on the cross. And Aaron's sons, the Aaronic priesthood, the priest shall sprinkle blood around the altar. The blood here is the literal blood of the animal that represents the spiritual death of Jesus Christ on the cross as we understand it, as we observe the Lord's table. And so that emphasizes and highlights the work of Christ on the cross that provided for us the reconciliation or the peace contract, peace accord between man and God that removed the sin barrier that creates animosity between man and God. And for the sacrifice of peace offerings, he shall present an offering by fire to the Lord, the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails. And the two kidneys with the fat that is on them. Fat generally symbolizes purity. Which is on the loins, the lobe of the liver, which he shall remove with the kidneys. And then Aaron's sons shall offer it up and spoke on the altar, verse 5, on the burnt offering, which is on the wood, it is on the fire, it is offered by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. It denotes that that teaches the doctrine of propitiation. In front of the tabernacle proper in the outer court, that's where you had the bronze altar. And that's where they performed the sacrifice. Now this was a big production. You know, it wasn't some charcoal grill that they had out there that they slapped a piece of meat on. They had to burn whole animals. And you got to deal with all the blood, all the leftovers, etc. So they would have a trench and things made that would obviously drain all the blood away from the bronze altar. And the bronze altar in the outer court, that teaches and symbolizes salvation phase one. Faith in Christ to get into heaven. The bronze laver going into the tabernacle, that represents rebound to go in and do the service of God experientially. And the priest obviously was under the regimen that if they failed to wash their feet before they entered in with that bronze laver, they were under the penalty of death if it was carried out right. But the sacrifices themselves, the burnt sacrifices, obviously here shows it represents the person of Jesus Christ's work on his cross, on the cross. The doctrine of propitiation means that God was satisfied with what Jesus Christ did on the cross. Propitiation simply means satisfaction. But if his offering for a sacrifice, the peace offering to the Lord is from the flock, verse 6, that he shall offer male or female without defect. Different animals could be used. And obviously not everybody could afford a bull, a steer, maybe any sheep. So for all they could bring was a dove or a pigeon, something of that nature. But the room is made so that anyone could go in and make their sacrifices. And here we have the different ways it could be done. It can be male or female without defect, again, symbolizing the sinless character of Christ. Verse 7, if he is going to offer a lamb for his offering, then he shall offer it before the Lord, before Yahweh. He shall lay his hand on the head of the offering, verse 8, and slay it before the tent of meeting. That's out there in the outer court, the bronze altar. And Aaron's son shall sprinkle his blood around on the altar. And one of these days they're going to crank this up again. And Peter is going to go fall apart. Bring it on. If they start doing that, we're out of here. I guarantee you that. If we get that far into it. And the two kidneys, or verse 9, and from the sacrifice of peace offerings, he shall bring as an offering by fire to the Lord his fat, the entire fat tail, which he shall remove close to the backbone, and the fat that covers the entrails, and all the fat that is on the entrails. Purity, the different organs all have symbolic value. I can't tell you what they all are at this point. And the two kidneys with the fat that is on them, which is on the loins and the liver, verse 10, which you shall remove with the kidneys. Verse 11, the priest shall offer it up and smoke on the altar as food and offering by fire to the Lord. Smoke reaching up to heaven is seen to, again, propitiate. It also represents prayer, such as burning the incense on the prayer table in the tabernacle, etc. Is it soothing to God, or does it stink? Verse 12, moreover, if this offering is a goat, then he shall offer it before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on his head and slay it before the tent of meeting. Sons of Aaron shall sprinkle his blood around on the altar. Verse 14, and Prince shall present his offering as an offering by the fire of the Lord. Fat that covers the entrails, the fat that is on the entrails. And the two kidneys with the fat is on them, which is on the loins and lobe of the liver, which you shall remove from the kidneys. And the priest shall offer them up and smoke on the altar as food, an offering by fire for a soothing aroma. All fat is the Lord's. All fat is the Lord's. The purity belongs to God. He's the one that has a plus R. It's the only way the only place you're going to find it. For all your problems, all your issues and troubles in life, the only solution you're going to find, the only place you're going to find a real solution for this is in God. See? Because all those problems come about basically based on the very presence and existence of the sin nature and negative volition, obviously fueling it. 17 is a perpetual statute throughout your generations and all your dwellings. You shall not eat any fat or any blood. It is all belongs to God. He brings about these realities. So that would denote his preoccupation with Jesus Christ. Our evidence of preoccupation with Jesus Christ is seen in the very way our church is set up and how we operate. Our preoccupation with Jesus Christ is seen in the fact that our nose is in the Bible every hour that we're here, operating, obviously, in our Bible class. The total involvement in regards to the truth of doctrine and what it means, and searching it out. Finally, further, it would offer occasion for prayer for continued divine guidance. 19, now that Elohim, God, is here referred to as, quote, the God of his father Isaac, end quote, is a scribal clue to point towards Isaac as the terminus ad quo for the relocation event now in process. The prophecy all began with Isaac. So it's my interpretation that Moses puts this in, pins it in, to give everyone a clue. Guess what? This prophecy is being fulfilled, and there is a change in it where they're going to now go into Egypt to fulfill this prophecy. It is complete. Hence his father Isaac. That's where it all began. So he wants you to think about Isaac. Well, what's Isaac have to do with this? Well, I'll tell you what it has to do with it. He's the beginning of the prophecy. See? So it's how you come to an epinosis of that. 20, the mature believer never loses sight on the basis for all his blessing and deliverance. And in fact, becomes more impressed and occupied with the one that makes all things possible. Whatever Israel, Jacob, went through in life, however he may have stumbled, however he may have failed, he never lost the focus and vision in regards to his NPR. In regards to that where he knew the lifeline truly existed in regards to keeping him going and keeping his head above water spiritually. In spite of what the failings and weaknesses he may have had on the way. And in fact, the more one is on doctrine, the more one recognizes that that's what you really got to be preoccupied with. Satan will dangle out there in front of you the proverbial carrot or whatever to try to distract you in regards to your NPR. Don't let him do it. That comes about and is supported in regards to your motivation, your drive, your perseverance. Based on the fact that you maintain your doctrinal vision as dominant in regards to how you view life and look at life and pursue life. And the longer you're on doctrine, truly, the more appreciation and depth of understanding that comes along with that is exposed in regards to the mature believer's life. And seeing, the Bible is true. God is real. His word does come to pass exactly as he brings it out. And things in life otherwise tend to lose, if you will, at least the original fleshly appeal that they might have had otherwise earlier on in your life, more in a state of immaturity and things of this nature. All these things, really, how important is it when you compare it to your eternal's life niche? And ultimately, what all this is going to mean for us. Not that these things are not still part of your life. Not that they're not still appreciated and enjoyed. But that's not your ultimate preoccupation. If it came down to which string you're going to cut, you know which one it'll be. It will not be NPR. See? Basically, the paradox in regards to the being a mature believer is that You basically want to suckle doctrine like you did in your immaturity, but even more so as a mature adult believer. You want it more and more. You can't get enough. See? And to hang in there with it ultimately always pays off. Just as it's going to pay off for Jacob. And there is no better time, point 22, than to engage in worship and prayer than when one is struggling with their SCA and having doubts otherwise. Again, we see fear being a dominant STA trend in regards to the patriarchs. And I'm convinced that fear is a dominant sin trend that basically permeates the human race in one form or fashion. And obviously, if you can't see that over the last couple of years, then I don't know what else to help you with. How the world has reacted. I guess nobody's ready to meet their maker yet. Oh, I'm going to die. God wanted to kill you, you'd be done, dead, and gone. Not to be cavalier in regards to taking care of yourself. But this whole emotional upheaval of life in humans. And that's how do you think Satan is able to control the human race so easily? Through fear. And unscrupulous men and women alike in positions of authority and power have figured that out a long time ago, and they've been using that whip against the human race since the beginning of time almost. And when you're having trouble, when things are testings are tough, the SCA just won't let go, it seems like sometimes. Yeah, that happens. That's part of the course of life. Don't get yourself off balance. If you find yourself struggling in certain areas of your life, we all do. Every believer that's walked on this planet does and has and will. See. But your antidote, your prescription, your lifeline is maintaining your NPR. To come and take the doctrine that you have already and have it reinforced. If not, gapping new information otherwise that will help you see more clearly or at least see for the present what you need to do in order to deal with your tests in life and sufferings and overruling your SGA, etc. It was at Beersheba that God appeared to Jacob, battling his STA in a dream, providing him with doctrine pertinent to his situation of heading towards Haran. That was all the way back in Genesis 28, 10 through 17. So, it's fitting. Jacob gets under his STA after what he did with his father Isaac. And his brother Esau, he's running for his life. He's headed to his uncle Haran. And on the way, guess what? It is the very place that he's at now to worship that he stops. And God appears to him on that occasion there in a dream. Remembering back when. And it's all designed to encourage him. To stay on his path, and God will be with him. God reads our tape. God read Jacob's tape. In spite of what Jacob was doing at the time, he saw in him polyvolition. See? And he recognized that, and that's how God responds. And Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran back then, and he came to a certain place and spent the night there, verse 11, because the sun had set, and he took one of the stones of the place, placed it under his head, and lay down in the place. And he had a dream. Behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. Behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. So he had been immediately in Beersheba. And he set out from there. But Beersheba is still identified with the situation. That's what I'm bringing out. And the angels of God were sitting, descending on it. Verse 13, behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord your God, your father Abraham, the God of Isaac, the land of which you lie. I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth. You shall spread out to the west, to the east, to the north and south. And in you and your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. In other words, you're inheriting the covenant from your fathers Abraham and Isaac. Blessed. And behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And Jacob awoke from his place. Surely the Lord is in his place, and he did not know it. And I did not know it. And there he got under mysticism, as we remember back there. That now all of a sudden, the place is special. Instead of what was really special was the revelation of divine viewpoint given to him by God. And he was afraid, verse 17, said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. So, Beersheba in the vicinity, God appeared to Jacob there in a dream. And he was definitely running on his STA at this point in time in his life. So, I just see a connection between the two. So 24, Jacob's endeavor and insight now is rewarded in verse 2. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night. He gives him an audible. And he uses a theophany in vision. To give appearance to the audible. Wow, Amar, Elohim, Lamed, Israel, Bet Mara, Mer, Ah, Ha, the La Yela. So, what Israel saw on this occasion, point 25, we are not told, but appears in various forms during the night, indicated by the plural noun visions. It's in the plural. So, there's more than just one vision that occurred. Our word Merah. So what is recorded, point 26,